Kua, Reel 3. Yes, you were saying about your arrival in Australia, Nikki, but before we get there, if I could go back to the Dunera.
Yes.
And ask you generally, you know, a little more about the crew and the guards. It would seem from what you say that the behaviour was very different from that on the Arundora Star.
Entirely different, yes. Yes. Quite, yes. They came down most days and took rings away. They took watches away, or anything of value that we had left. We didn't have any other things, but they came down regularly and took all these things that we had, as I say, had left. And then as time went on, there was nothing left, and our leader, Colonel Borghi, who was our leader for quite a while, went to the captain and made remarks, actually, about the soldiers coming down and doing these things, which the captain said, well, I'll see what I can do about it. And then he came down himself, the captain, and said, I hear you have accused some of my men of taking rings, etc. He said, well, I will not argue about that. But if you have any valuables left, if you will put them all in one bag and give them to me, I will return them to you when you get to your permanent camp. Now, I'm afraid I'd lost faith by that time. And I had this ring, which I still have, my 21st birthday. And I thought, well, I'm not going to give it up. I shall hide it somewhere, which I hid it in a certain place. But the others gave a nice little bag of the rest of the valuables, including my friend Vic, his signet ring, and handed them over and never saw them again. So I was glad I'd kept this. I think I was one of the only ones that was sort of getting disbelieving at that time, you know. So I saved this worn-out ring now that I've had, 53 years, got there, which I'm glad I saved.
That was a catch.
And the the English captain, who was at the house in the Parliament there, he was accused and also degraded. The pips were taken off. Actually, the three officers lost their pips. You can check on that sort of thing, because it's the Jews who got it out. We, or our leader, Colonel Borghi, tried to get in touch with the Brazilian embassy, who was representing Italy, and then the Swiss embassy was representing Italy, to complain about this journey, and nothing was ever done. But the Jewish leader managed to get a letter, how I still don't know, to the chief rabbi of New York. How on earth he got this letter, it's a miracle, I should think, because we couldn't get anything out, censored. And the chief rabbi of New York got in touch with the English government, the British government, and that's why it was brought into the Houses of Parliament. And the Jews were paid out a certain sum of money for the losses they had, and they also had these officers, the pips taken off or whatever. So it was quite a big case, but it was more for the Jews than what happened to the Italians and the Germans, you see. They brought it to light.
Because you were saying about the watch, you know, of your friend, the
Hunter watch. Well, that was before going on board the Dunera,
yes.
But that carried on afterwards.
Yeah. And didn't he get anything for that?
No. None of the Italians ever got a penny for anything like that. It was only the Jews that were paid out. And I made that clear at the at this West Hampstead synagogue or Jewish centre that I just spoke to Terry about, that a lady stood up and said that we should now claim money because of the treatment and the losses. And I stood up, I said, Madam, you're not up to date. Your community was paid. 1942, I said, you can go and check on that. I said, the Italians received not one penny. I said, you received for the things you lost. We did not receive anything. And that is a fact.
Yes. I understand that Major Layton, and I think you mentioned his name earlier,
that's right.
was the chap who went to
That's right,
Australia.
He came to Australia. Yes.
And was he not interested in interviewing the Italians? Did he not?
No, he interviewed the Italians inasmuch to see whether they should be released. That was the whole idea. And I say 75% would have been released, but Australia didn't want us out there. So they had to wait to get a ship to come back. And 45 came back and the ship was sunk. Again, off the coast of South Africa, there were a lot of U-boats there. So the second lot wouldn't go back. They said, no, we're going to stay here and think of our families, although we'd love to be back, but we're not going to risk our necks again. So he came over there to give a tribunal to all those people, not to us youngsters, because we didn't stand a chance. We were military age and we could have been a threat had we had those intentions. We could have been saboteurs or fifth columnists or that sort of thing. We understood that. We've always understood it, the youngsters. It's the older people that we were against. There were 70-year-olds, 60, 70-year-olds. Most of our group was over a certain age. As I say, I had the hut for the youngsters. There's only 32 of us. And there were some older people in the camp, in the hut as well, who wanted to come in our group.
Well, was your father on the Daniera with you?
Oh, yes, came on, yes. They carried him off in a stretcher because he was too weak. We all lost 3 or 4 stones. And I was, actually, they used to lay me on the table and my ribs showed so much they used to play the xylophone on it with the spoons. Just as to have a laugh, you know. There was the youngsters that, even in those conditions, we carried on enjoying ourselves, put it that way. Mm. Not enjoying ourselves because there was dysentery on board and I had to come through the Italian section to go to the toilets.
Yes, I was going to ask you now, you know, if you wouldn't mind again keeping to the Daniera before we get into Australia, about the conditions, the sort of accommodation, first of all.
Well, the accommodation was really terrible because there was 200 Italians and there were 20 on each table. There was 10 long tables, which made 200. And the only way to be able to sleep or to lie down was to sleep under the table, on the seat, on the table, and a few lucky ones at a hammock. So that was the only way that we could all lay down, so it shows you the space. And in the middle of it all was a big staircase that hundreds of them came every day to go to the toilet, which was at the back of ours. And when dysentery broke, of course, it was disastrous. And there again, the food was very, very, very poor. We all lost, stones and stones. And my father was carried off in a stretcher amongst other people who were so weak that we couldn't survive, really. But I say, there again, the youngsters, we used to get up in the middle of the night and go into the toilet when everybody else was sleeping and turn on all the water onto the sinks in the Indian Ocean, that the sea was so bad that all the sinks would be full of water, and as the ship went side by side, the water would come over as a shower. And that was the only way we could do it, you know, about 2 or 3 in the morning. But there again, the youngsters, we were, not enjoying ourselves, but we were making the best of things. Whereas the older people, of course, suffered quite a lot, you know.
Did the Italians get dysentery, you know?
Oh, yes, we all had it, yes.
Mm-hmm. So what were the toilet facilities to cope with that?
Oh, they were terrible. Shocking thing. It was a terrible state. I can tell you a tale of myself and Victorine and my father, that the sea was so rough in the Indian Ocean that we had this stew one day, which was a bit of luck because it was usually a plate of macaroni for 22 people, you know. We had one spoon each. And then, of course, there were arguments. After a while, you know, nerves get tense and you've got more than I have, you know, even amongst ourselves. It was unavoidable. And this Jewish man, who was 2 decks below us, came down and he slipped on this staircase, which was filthy, with dysentery and the oil and the seawater, absolutely filthy, and he slipped. And of course this stew came tumbling down And I was under a table with my father and Vic. We were sleeping on a table. And I saw these pieces of meat. And I crawled out just like a dog and picked up two pieces. Gave one to my father. And I had one myself. And my friend picked one up as well. Now, if anybody had told me this before the war, because I'm rather fastidious and there, that I would do a thing like that, I would most probably have hit him to say that I would do a thing like that. But in the conditions that we were glad for this one piece of meat. And there was a lot of incidents there, that some were rather silly anyway, that we did. But I say, as youngsters, the man who was sleeping at the end of the table, his head was sort of the edge of the table here, down there, and there was we used to have a can of water a day. And as the ship was going up and down, this can was going down there, then the ship was this, so it was coming here, and it was coming nearer and nearer to the edge, and we were saying, wait and see, he'll get a shower. And we shouldn't have done that, really, thinking of it. And then it did come there, and of course, water went over him, and he started swimming, you know, thinking of the Arandora. Which wasn't a good thing. We shouldn't have done it, you know, to Jove, and then we apologised a lot to him afterwards. But his mind, as soon as water came over him, was to start swimming again, you know, and he was a very famous chef, chef of the St. Ermines. Of course, we had 14 of the best chefs in London, you know, in our group. Once we got to Australia, of course, the food, it was always lamb, but they did it up in so many different ways that it was marvellous. And Major Layton, we invited him in. I don't suppose he told you. We invited him in to have lunch. And he says, you know, you people are lucky here. I can't get a meal like this at the Savoy Hotel. I said, well, lucky for you, you can go to the Savoy Hotel. So he had a wonderful lunch there. And so it's, as I say, he made his tribunal. And 75% of the men would have been released had they been in England. Shows you the mistake they made when they locked them up in June.
The other thing, you know, you were saying about the Dunera, Nicky, if I could still keep with this, because yes, it is so interesting,
yes,
your account. Were you allowed out on deck, you know, for boat drill or exercise?
No, no boat drill at all. Exercise, we were allowed to go round at a trot. After a certain time that we'd been on there, we would go up there and there were machine guns at each corner there, and one Jewish man did dive overboard. He said he couldn't stand it anymore. So, and then there was another case of, there we were behind barbed wire, going back on the Arandora. We were not behind barbed wire and Arandora, but we were on the Dunera. You couldn't get out at all. It was up the stairs and there was barbed wire all round. That was the case of that. And one of the men, Fleisch, his name was Fleisch, I met him after the war, he went up to ask for something or other, and the guards stabbed him with the bayonet in the stomach. He came down, he says, Nick, he says, I said, what on earth happened? Anyway, they took him to the hospital and he, quite well, and after the war, he opened up the first one of the first vegetarian restaurants in Leicester Square. I went to see him and his brother, and they had a meal with him there, got there. And that, as I say, going back to the barbed wire, there we were behind barbed wire. And when the bang came of the second torpedo, we all rushed to try and get out, but we just couldn't get out because we were behind the barbed wire. So if the explosion had gone off, none of us would have survived on the Dunera.
Yes, was there a lot of fear and panic because, you know, when those torpedoes came?
Well, yes, yes. I'm afraid there wasn't panic. It was pushing and shoving, trying to get out of this trapdoor. There was only a trapdoor to get out of, which was covered with barbed wire. So we just waited there, and as a matter of fact, we tried to get up there with my father and Vic. I've always been with Vic. And we said, there's no chance here. So we just calmly went down and laid under the table waiting for the inevitable. And then, of course, it didn't happen, you know. So we were lucky. Otherwise, nobody would have saved. No Italian would have saved themselves down there. And none of the Germans underneath us, I don't think, and then the Jews beneath us again. There was no way out at that time. I don't know about the ones who were in the front part of the ship, because there was about 3,000 people on board, you know. And when we landed, we were complaining about the food and that, and they said, well, they had 3,000 sausages in a day. They didn't say that there were 3,000 people on board. That was the difference, you know, which was rather a bit of a joke.
Is the different groups, you know, the Germans, these would have been the patriotic Germans, wouldn't
That's
they?
That's right, yes.
And the Italians,
yes.
And the Jews. Was there, would you say there was tension at all between
Not
the
on board, not on board the ship, no. No, none at all. Not on the Donera. No way. And the camps, of course, we were separated anyway. The Jews went to Hayes in New South Wales, and the Germans and Italians stayed in separate camps in Victoria, state of Victoria. Then we were moved about from here to there, but...
You say that morale was much lower on the Donera than, say, the Arendolle.
Oh, yes, definitely, yes. As the time went on, definitely, you know, the first few days, but 55 days is a fair while, you know. And morale had gone down very, very low. Yes, I'm afraid so. Got there towards the end. We just didn't know where we were going to land, or if we were going to land, or whether we were going to be kept on a ship for goodness knows how long. So morale was very low, I must admit that. We still made the best of it, the youngsters, but in general, the morale had gone down a terrific lot. The older people were sort of giving up and thinking of their families and that, you know. There was, as I said, there were a lot of old people on board, over 60s, over 70s. My father was only 55, but a lot of the others were much older. Got there. There was a manager of the Carlogatti Ice Company, who was the ones who used to take the ice round, all round London. Spaggiari, and there was Frepoli. They were all a certain age. Some who had sons in the British Army, I told you. As a matter of fact, there was a case, not amongst our lot, but that the son was on guard outside, his father was on one side of barbed wire and he was on the other side. Not in our lot, as I say, but on the Isle of Man somewhere. So it was a really, as I say, collared a lot. It was a panic stations. And when they realised it, of course, for our lot, we were so many miles away, they couldn't do anything about it. But they did send Major Leighton to release them, but Australia didn't want us out. They didn't want any of us out there.
I think it's time now for me to concentrate on Australia, or to let you concentrate on it.
Yeah, well, whatever you like, yes.
When you arrived, and you say this was Melbourne...
Melbourne.
Can you remember your initial impressions, you know, getting off the boat and how the Australians...
Well, the Australians had been told that there was a dangerous crowd of Italians coming, who were fifth columnists, saboteurs and spies and etc., etc. And this, after I spoke to one of the guards there, and we got off, and it was heavily fortified, put it that way, the dock, heavily fortified, expecting to see these people. And they saw this crowd of badly dressed, unruly Italians, skinny, absolutely, everybody had lost at least 2-3 stones, no doubt about it. And they thought, well, there's some mistake here. This was told to me by a guard afterwards. We've got the wrong people here. Look at these people, all old. They're all older than the guards were themselves, and that. And there's something wrong here. And of course, they relaxed a little. They made a mistake, and we were just put on the train up there with guards, quite a lot of guards there, who some have offered cigarettes, and we were afraid to take them because the guards used to offer cigarettes on the Donera to the heavy smokers who couldn't do without a cigarette. And when they went to take it, they would hit them on their hands with a rifle, you see. So we'd learned that, and we said, no, thank you. I said, we don't smoke. What's the matter with you guys, you know, real Australian? We said, no, thank you. And then slowly, we told them what used to happen, you know, on board there. And they said, can't believe it. I said, that's why we're afraid to take anything. You know, we don't want to be hit anymore. So they sort of understood it. And then by the time we'd reached the camp, we were quiet. And as one of us says, these bastards can speak better English than we do. That was a thing between themselves, you know, because we all came from London. And the older men didn't speak English very well because they hadn't had much schooling anyway. But the youngsters, of course, even a few swear words, you know, so that's why they said these bastards are speaking English better than we do to each other, you know, cobber and all the things. And, of course, we stopped at Seymour, the first station. I remember that very well. It's 50-odd years ago. And they gave us tea and cake and that, which we hadn't tasted for 3-4 months, you know, or more than that. And then we got to the camp. And, of course, there was so much food there. It was incredible, you know. We had a tin of marmalade each and a sort of leg of lamb each and a loaf each, which we couldn't eat anyway when you've eaten so little. But we really had marvellous. First time I had melon and ginger jam. I thought it was marvellous, you know. I never had it in England, actually, that mixture. And, of course, once we were in Australia and we arranged as I say, we had 14 of the best chefs in London. One of the chefs worked in Buckingham Palace. One was a chef of the Mauritania. My father was chef of the Criterion. All round there, they're all head chefs. And they got organised, and as I say, it was sheep, sheep, and sheep. We had 3/4 of a sheep every day as ration. But they did it in so many different ways that you didn't mind, you know. We had a lot of pumpkin, and they would give that as a starter, as a veg, and as a sweet, done in a different way. So we were very well off, put it that way, you know. We were inside a camp, not allowed out, not even to work, unfortunately. Because we did not come under the Prisoner of War Geneva Convention. We were civilian prisoners. So there was nothing that covered us at all. Had we been soldiers, then we had a lot of rights and whatever. But being civilians, there was nothing that covered a civilian. So, but we didn't suffer in the camp at all. There was no danger and there was food. What more could you ask, you know? And you couldn't go out. Well, that was just bad luck, you know.
That camp was Tatura.
Tatura, yes. Number 2.
Yes. Did you organise yourselves, though?
You know, yes. Complete organisation was in the camp. I opened a shop with everything inside because they all had money sent from England. And I opened up a shop with everything, food and cigarettes and that sort of thing. I got the stuff once a week from Melbourne. And the profits that we made, and we did quite well, we used to use it to supplement the money they were paying for the people who looked after the sanitary part and the kitchen. They were giving a shilling a day to only so many. So we had more people working, cleaning the camp. And that, so we used to pay out of the profits from the canteen, which I did, and we could order anything because although Australia, they had a limit in the restaurants, but you could get anything you wanted there. There was no rationing there or anything. So I just ordered everything and they would... Oh, once we were in Australia, if you have interviewed anybody who's been in Australia who complained about the treatment or the food or whatever, I will dispute it with him any time. The trip over to Australia, 55 days, was shocking. But once in Australia, apart from being locked in a cage sort of thing, if anybody complains, I will argue with him till the cows come home, put it that way.
How about your social life, you know, within the camp? Did you arrange things?
Oh, yes, they arranged that. There were all sorts of classes. The other doctor, Dr. Manzocchi from Shepherd's Market, he gave lessons in Spanish. And then we had the famous Matania, who gave lessons in painting. He was a great, well-known one here, him and his brother. The Matanya brothers were very well-known in England.
Were they related to the famous Matanya of the Renaissance period?
I don't know if it was there, but he was the Matanya, Fortunino Matanya, was the one who used to do all these paintings whenever there was a coronation or a jubilee, and they had all this in the Westminster Abbey. And he was the one that used to paint all the details and that sort of thing. He was supposed to be the best. He was always commissioned for those. This was his brother, who was actually a marvellous painter, but he was more on music, the one who was in the camp with us. And he was sort of teaching music, and he formed a little band. We got a lot of stuff from the Italian community in Melbourne. There, they sent us lots of things there, if we wanted anything, through the priest. He was Father Owen, who used to come and say Mass once a week. And then we arranged all different things. There was woodwork, there was... Guido Baldi was marvellous on his working things there with Gino Guarnieri and Barber, of course, Barbieri. It's funny, his name was Barbieri and Barber, you know, from Wales. And I was in the canteen, and I also had, I was hut leader, but that didn't take much except keeping them in order and cleanliness and that. Yes, well, this is number two camp. This was our very first camp, which we returned to after two or three years, after touring round to South Australia and all over the place, actually. But this was the first one, which was a very, very nice camp, as camps go.
That was Tatura.
Tatura. This is number two camp, Tatura. And there were two compounds, the A and B. We were in the B and the Germans were in the A, with the... wire, barbed wire between us, of course. And as you entered, the first thing you saw was the mess room on the left-hand side, then the kitchen and the other mess room. Then on the right, first of all, there were three huts, 32 people in each hut, and behind there was the fourth, fifth, sixth and seventh hut. And then there was 18 huts altogether, so about 11 huts were empty, actually. And we had our little church after the mess room there, and then the orderly room, and then at the end we'd made the laundry for everybody. And at the side we had our own bowling greens, the bocce pitches, as the Italians called them. And then we'd also made a jumping ground, I see, for our sports, which we had. And we also had a football pitch somewhere. We had all the clotheslines at the bottom there for hanging up, although it was so hot that if you did hang them outside your hut, they'd be dry in about half an hour, you know. And of course we stayed here, I don't remember exactly the amount of time, but then they moved us to another camp, which was rather number four camp, which was nicer because it was divided in four. Now section had a sort of huts divided into little cubicles. So it was two per cubicle, which was rather nice. Until the early December 1941, when Japan came into the war. So a few days after they came into the war, they moved us out, because they wanted to put Japanese families in there. So they had small rooms for husband and wife, you see. So they moved us. It was very, very sad to move from there, because it was marvellous. Because we actually made some tennis courts outside for the officers, as I used to play a lot of tennis. Not a great player, but I used to play a lot of tennis. And the officers had asked us to make these tennis courts, to build them actually, and we only agreed if they would let us play for a while. You know, Dr. Zezzi was a champion, amateur, Italian amateur tennis champion actually, the doctor from Harley Street. And they had
said, right, well, you can have them for 2 hours in the morning, and the officers will use them for the rest of the week. So we agreed, and we built it outside, and we were sorry to leave there, of course, because they transferred us about 1,000 miles away to Loveday, where we were put under tents, and nobody knew anything about a tent, including myself. They were all cooks and waiters, no idea whatsoever. And of course, the first dust storm that came, and there were a terrific lot of dust storms there, took all the tents away. They hadn't even been pegged properly, you see. So we were moved, let's say, 1,200 miles, I think, to Loveday in South Australia, where we stayed for quite a while. And then we were brought back to Tatura.